From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday and Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here for an update on what's going on in government in Sullivan County. We'll have an update on the opioid settlement funds and a COVID vaccine update. CCE caregivers. Research shows that participation in a support group can reduce caregiver stress and improve quality of life for both the caregiver and care receiver. Cornell Cooperative Extension Sullivan County's Caregiver Resource Center provides support to the informal family caregiver. And we'll talk to a name you might recognize, Nancy McGraw, Program Coordinator. Plus, the Woodstock Film Festival is back, and it has socially justice-themed cinema. And we'll talk to Myra Blaustein, the co-founder and executive director, about the lineup. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. This hour, the United Auto Workers are expected to announce whether they will expand their selective strike against the three U.S. automakers. The UAW has demanded significant progress in contract talks with Ford, GM, and Stellantis. From member station WFPL, Jacob Munoz reports union workers in Louisville, Kentucky are waiting to see if they'll join others on the picket line today.
So far, workers at three plants are on strike. UAW Local 862 in Louisville represents more than 12,000 Ford employees at two assembly plants. One of those workers is LaTanya Covington, who attended a Thursday union rally in the city.
We're showing support across the board, not just for the UAW, for the working class. We want the working class to finally get what they deserve.
One Louisville location could be a tempting target for the union to strike at. This past spring, Ford CEO Jim Farley described the city's Kentucky truck plant as the company's most profitable plant globally. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Munoz in Louisville.
Members of the House of Representatives have gone home for the weekend, even though they've tried and failed to pass key spending legislation. House Republicans cannot agree among themselves on a spending bill. That disagreement means the federal government is getting very close to a partial shutdown on October 1st. Senators like North Dakota Republican Kevin Cramer are urging their House colleagues to hammer out a compromise.
I think it's really important that they get something that they can send over to us, regardless of what it might look like.
Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons had this suggestion.
We may need to send them a proposal because they're not able to get anything together.
House Republicans are divided over whether to provide aid for public disasters and over aid for Ukraine. Federal prosecutors in New York say they plan to announce an indictment against New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez on bribery charges. The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York announced on social media Menendez's wife, Nadine, will also be charged. Stocks opened mixed this morning as Microsoft neared a green light for its modified acquisition of a video game maker. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 50 points in early trading.
Shares of game maker Activision Blizzard rose on news that UK regulators are likely to approve Microsoft's purchase of the company. Authorities had earlier raised concerns that the deal would stifle competition in cloud-based gaming. Regulators now say those worries were substantially addressed by the company's agreement to sell cloud-based rights to a rival. European regulators have slapped Intel with another fine for alleged anti-competitive activity in the computer chip market. The $400 million penalty comes after a larger fine issued more than a decade ago was thrown out by a court. And Amazon plans to start showing commercials on its Prime Video streaming service next year. Customers can skip the ads by paying an extra $2.99 a month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The National Hurricane Center says a potential tropical storm is about 250 miles off the coast of the Carolinas. Top sustained winds are at 50 miles per hour. The storm could make landfall later today. Forecasters have issued tropical storm warnings from North Carolina to southern Delaware. The school building in Parkland, Florida, where a former student killed 17 people in 2018, will be demolished next summer. From member station WLRN, Gerard Albert reports, local school officials made the announcement yesterday.
The long-awaited demolition of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School building will happen immediately after the current school year ends. The building has remained largely untouched for more than 5.5 years, so it could be used as evidence during the shooter's trial. The interior was left as it was in the aftermath of the shooting, with jurors touring its hallways during the sentencing phase. And last month, members of Congress did the same. In between, loved ones were finally allowed to enter and retrieve belongings of those killed. The Broward County School Board has not yet signaled what will become of the property. For NPR News, I'm Gerard Albert III in Fort Lauderdale.
There's an active volcano near the capital of the Philippines, Manila. It's continuing to belch volcanic gases. Authorities say it's creating so much volcanic smog, they're telling schools in the capital and in neighboring towns to close. There are reports that students have gotten sick. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll speak to Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government in a moment, but first, a six-member jury unanimously decided that Sullivan County Legislature Chair Robert Daugherty had defamed his predecessor, County Legislature Louis Alvarez, when he publicly claimed that Mr. Alvarez had used a sexual slur against a female county commissioner, and he further claimed that this allegation was founded. The jury returned its verdict after about 2 hours of deliberation following a three-day trial in Monticello at which 10 witnesses testified. Mr. Alvarez initiated his lawsuit in the spring of 2021. In his testimony, Mr. Alvarez told the jury that clearing his name and restoring his reputation motivated his lawsuit, not money. The jury awarded neither compensatory nor punitive damages to Mr. Alvarez. Mr. Daugherty has not yet publicly commented. Mr. Alvarez has issued a press release via his attorney saying, quote, "I feel vindicated and appreciate the hard work of this jury and of presiding judge Bryant," end quote. Both Mr. Alvarez and Mr. Daugherty are both seeking re-election as legislators this November. Now, every Friday, we're joined by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. And Dan, good morning. I do have to ask you, any comment there from county government?
No, there's no comment from the county government. We will let the legislators involved speak for themselves on that. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rob has something to say about it as well. But right now, the only statement that I refer people to is the statement by Legislator Alvarez, Louis and his attorney that you read from. And there's a longer statement out there that people can access.
You do have some information about the election, though, from the Board of Elections this morning. Just got your sample ballots in.
Yeah, they just emailed me the PDF that I'm going to put up on the website of the sample ballots. So later today, if you're listening to this live, later today, it's going to be up on the website, hopefully about midday or early afternoon. I know I look forward to seeing those, and I think a lot of other people do as well. Because the sample ballots, while you can't use them to vote, you can use them to understand how you're going to vote once you do get to the polls. They will show you exactly what the actual ballot is going to look like. So you will understand who is running for which position where. And this is a very important local election. We've got almost all our legislative spots are contested. Both incumbents and candidates who are looking to have voters put them in that seat. And then we have lots of town level elections as well. So I will probably have a lot of work ahead of me here to put it up, but I look forward to it because for me, a big thing, and this goes back to my days as a journalist as well, is for people to be informed voters, to understand who's on the ballot, what lines they're running under. And I encourage people to go beyond what I'm going to be providing and seek out these candidates personally. If they have websites or social media pages, look at those and understand their positions, their philosophy, and whether it aligns with yours, because you have the ultimate power as a voter.
And we had on the chairs of the Sullivan County GOP and Democratic parties on Tuesday, which was National Voter Registration Day, encouraging folks to vote, register to vote. The election is November 7th. There's early voting. Each state has its different deadlines, but you can go to the Sullivan County Department of Elections and find out about early voting and those deadlines there. If you're in Pennsylvania, you can go to vote.pa.gov to find out about where to register to vote and the deadlines in that state.
And then if you're listening to us elsewhere in New York, you can go to elections.ny.gov to find out more from the New York State Board of Elections and how to register, how to vote, and what those deadlines are. And again, important to make your voice heard.
I think I'll be talking about it now every week that I'm here until Election Day, because it is crucially important. Too many people just come out for a presidential election. The presidential election, yes, it affects your life, but not in the way local elections do.
That's what I asked Ann Hart, chair of the Democratic Party, and Greg Goldstein, chair of the GOP party in Sullivan County, about this not being one of those years where there's an overriding larger election. There's no presidential election. There's no bigger Senate seat or congressional seat that's vital or crucial. But what's vital and crucial are these local elections,
Absolutely.
Which impact the everyday lives of everybody here. And in Wayne and Pike, I believe there are also a large slate of folks that are up for election, too. I know in Wayne, I think all three commissioners in Wayne County are up.
They are.
And again, these are local issues. I guess we would refer to them as pocketbook issues in the past, but like your roads and, you know, the different types of policies in your towns. These are very important.
These are people who have more impact on your life than I think anybody at the federal level. State level, that may be a little different too. And I think there are some state level elections, at least on the New York side.
Yeah, there's like Supreme Court stuff going on. Yeah.
But this is the time to get out and vote. Don't just wait until it's the big name presidential race. Do it every year.
There you go. It's civic duty.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about something we talked about last week, the opioid settlement money that Sullivan County received. There was a group from the Sullivan County Drug Task Force who came to the legislature last week expressing some frustration that some of those funds had not been distributed. You have an update for us today.
Yes, I am pleased to share that legislators approved around $772,000 to be dispersed. That had been waiting to be dispersed. They had already allocated $400,000 to sheriff's office and DA's office, but yesterday they allocated, let me see here, $25,000 to Catholic Charities is for Good for Drugs, Too Good for Drugs school-based prevention. I need to get my glasses on better here. $334,000 to Catholic Charities for treatment services. $60,000 to $75,000 to Bold Gold Media Group for some advertising to get the word out about this. $33,000 to some billboard signage. $15,000 to the Village of Liberty Police Department for its quick response team. $11,000 for their officer employee assistance program because of what these officers have to deal with and see. $89,000 for Sullivan 180. $85,000 for Action Towards Independence, which is wraparound services for individuals with opioid use disorder, and $105,000 to the Corona Self-Help Center Incorporated. That's located in Jeffersonville. It's Empowerment Services and Peer Supports. It's a treatment center.
Mm-hmm. So those funds are getting released. That's not all of the funds. Let's remind folks again, like the amount that was distributed and why, and then like there's more coming.
There's more coming. Yeah. So there's already been distributed now. This would be about $1.2 million that's been distributed. There's more money coming. I don't know exactly how much is going to come our way, because I think some of the settlements are still happening, to my understanding. I think though we were anticipating between $7 and $9 million total that was going to be coming to Sullivan County. We haven't gotten all of that yet, but I am pleased to say we've started to disperse that. And I've been personally involved in efforts that have been going on for the past few years, even without these monies, to get the word out about opioid use disorder and the treatment thereof. Because, of course, as I unfortunately have to keep telling people, we have the highest opioid overdose rate in New York State. This is a serious issue. We all need to be involved in this, and this money will go a long way towards helping people, not only the people who need the treatment, but the people like the police officers who are helping these folks and need probably themselves some mental health and emotional supports because of what they see and deal with.
And these opioid settlements were from settlement funds from pharmaceutical companies that made and sold opioid painkillers. They're being paid out over the next 18 years to state and local governments across the country.
Yes.
Let's talk about what's been making news a little bit. COVID, a little bit of a resurgence here. The vaccines coming back last Friday. Do you have an update on vaccines for us?
Well, the update I wanted to offer right now, because people are starting to ask, is that we're just waiting to get some clarity from the state and the federal government. And as soon as we have that, we're going to announce where folks can get the COVID vaccine. Our public health team has been working very hard to find places to refer folks to. I know they've been polling the local pharmacies. I wish I had a little more concrete and detailed information. I was hoping I'd have that this morning because we have people asking. But right now, the best I can tell folks is check with your physician or your pharmacist if you're interested in getting these vaccines. And also make sure that you check with your insurance company. There's been some snafus with insurance companies, I'm hearing, where people have had to pay the full price for a vaccine, which is like around $120, when health insurance should be covering it. So the rollout of this hasn't been that great, I'm sorry to say. But we're getting our feet underneath us as fast as we can, because I already know, I don't know about you, but I already know people in my life who have gotten, I think, what is this new strain of COVID. And it's no more fun than the other one.
Right. At our website, wjffradio.org, there's a link to vaccines.gov where you can put in your zip code and find COVID-19 vaccine locations near you in that zip code. I just punched in my zip code and a few things popped up here. It looks as if it's saying they're in stock. Again, you should check appointment availability, check with the pharmacies, but it seems at least in our area there is some in stock. And again, go to vaccines.gov to check.
And call ahead. What you see there could may not be information about the prior vaccine, not the current vaccine.
Correct.
So I'm working very hard, and I hope as early as today to have some accurate information up that people can rely on. But we're still working on that because, unfortunately, it's been a little confusing.
And CDC recommends that everyone get the COVID-19 vaccines, the updated ones. Everyone 5 years and older should get one dose of the updated Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna COVID-19 vaccine to protect against serious illness from COVID-19. And children aged 6 months to 4 years need multiple doses of COVID-19 vaccines to be up to date. You can check at cdc.gov. And as I mentioned, also our website, wjffradio.org, has a link to the zip code tracker at vaccines.gov. There's also a COVID tracker, too, just to see, you know, how it is. It has ticked up, but not as serious as it once was. But again, we all need to remain diligent.
We're not finding hospitalizations have gotten into any kind of, well, to use a vernacular, red zone. Hmm. But I do know people all around me, actually,
me too,
who have dealt with it.
Yeah,
I'm fully vaccinated, and I have to say so far, knock on whatever wood is in here, my own head, that I haven't had any issues or symptoms. But yeah, this is not something to toy around with. These are safe and effective vaccines. They aren't 100% guarantee you won't get it, but they're as close as modern technology can get us to that, and I think they're wise for everyone to have.
We are speaking to Dan Hoost, Communications Director at Sullivan County Government, as we do every Friday. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more updates from Monticello with Dan Hoost. This is Radio Chatskill.
Cock-a-doodle-doo. That's Rooster Charles reminding you to listen to Farm and Country Saturday morning at 10. I'm your host, Rosie Starr. Join me, Charles, and all of our wonderful producers as we bring you the best of rural life and agriculture for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. That's Farm and Country, Saturday morning at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
Join Radio Catskill September 28th at our Community Awards, honoring individuals and organizations that bring a wide array of live theater offerings to the community. North American Cultural Laboratory, Harold Tai of the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop, and Franklin Trapp of the Forestburg Playhouse. Radio Catskill's Community Awards, Thursday, September 28th at Seminary Hill Orchard and Cidery, Calicoon. Tickets at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're joined every Friday by Dan Hoost, the communications director at Sullivan County Government, and he is here to tell us more about what's going on, including an honor for some deputies who helped save a man's life this summer. Again, we always talk about river safety, water safety. These deputies reacted quickly this summer when someone was drowning.
Yes, it was a guy from Rhode Island. He was kayaking on Swinging Bridge Reservoir with his 8-year-old son, according to what Sheriff's Office says. This was back in July. And our deputy, Sean Grady, and our detective, Eric Breihoff, were actually out on Marine Patrol. I just love that phrase, Marine Patrol, on Swinging Bridge Reservoir, which I think most people are familiar with. It's one of our largest boating lakes in the county. It's a hydroelectric reservoir south of Mungup Valley, a very popular place. It's why we have a Marine Patrol there. It's also a very long lake, so it's not like White Lake is a little more compact. You can see what's going on from most any vantage point. But Swinging Bridge, we actually have a boat out there. Our sheriff's office operates. They even have sometimes a drone that the coolest thing is when a thunderstorm is coming, they can deploy the drone. It has a loudspeaker on it. And it's like the voice of God above you saying, thunderstorm's coming. You might want to go in and get off the water. A thunderstorm's coming. So I don't know. That sounds a little freaky, too, but I'd rather know ahead of time. Anyway, these deputies were in the right place at the right time. They heard the screams of the son. His father was not, I don't know if he couldn't swim or just was having an issue in the water, but he was drowning, and he would have died had these deputies not been there to get right over there. They raced over there and lifted him up out of the water and saved this man's life. Well, the legislature yesterday thought that was definitely worthy of distinguished achievement awards for both Deputy Grady and Detective Breihoff, who have been with our sheriff's office a long time. So we thank them for what they do. This was something that had they not been there, we would have been talking about a fatality.
Mm-hmm. And again, always important to remember, wear a life jacket when you're out on any body of water. We have a new Sullivan County Emergency Services Training Coordinator, and he's got some big shoes to fill, huh?
Yes, he does. We got a guy named Joe Mall. He's from Jeffersonville, though, and he's replacing fellow Jeffersonville native and firefighter John Hauschild, who is now our Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety. John hasn't left us. He's just been promoted, and he's got a lot of duties. So we needed somebody to become what John had been for the past few years, which is our Emergency Services Training Center Coordinator. That's a mouthful. But Joe is filling those shoes nicely. We put out a press release about him earlier this week, introducing him to the public. Of course, he's well known in the Jeffersonville area. His father, Lee Mall, operated a excavation plumbing business, I think, for many, many years, where Joe got his experience. But Joe has also been with the Jeff Fire Department for nearly 25 years.
He mentions in this press release that he joined in November of 1998, shortly after he graduated from Jeff Youngsville High School. If those remember, that's what that high school used to be called. Now it's Sullivan West.
Yep, and it's now actually just Sullivan West Elementary School. There is, and the high school has moved over to Lake Huddington. But Joe is a native here, longtime emergency services person. We think he's going to do an excellent job. He already is at this Emergency Services Training Center.
And what are his responsibilities? What does emergency services do? It sounds like it's pretty explanatory in its title.
We have a building in the, I think I put it in the press release, sitting in the shadow of the county airport. It is right next to it. I spent 3 months there at the beginning of COVID. That was where my office was located because it was our emergency operations center, and I would hear the planes landing and taking off. But it includes all our equipment to respond to emergencies that wouldn't otherwise be located, like at the sheriff's office or at local police departments and fire departments. It also has a building that can be repeatedly used to simulate a facility on fire. And firefighters can go there and practice. So Joe's responsibility is to make sure all that equipment, all those facilities are in tip-top, ship-shape order, and also to make sure that he's coordinating with our fire departments and ambulance corps about the training that is required, the training that they want, and to be able to provide it there in one central location.
And these guys are training all the time.
Oh, yes, they are. This is a facility that is open almost every day of the week. Something's going on there.
And let's talk about the Delaware Valley Job Corps. They had a community breakfast yesterday.
Yes.
I've been over there and wasn't able to make it yesterday, but let's talk about them and the partnership that the county has with Delaware Job Corps.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I did not expect this. I thought this was just a breakfast where county officials were invited so they could show off Job Corps' facilities, which are very impressive. It's the former St. Joseph's Seraphic Seminary in Calicoon, which is that big clock tower that looms over town. And when you get in the building, it's like, wow, this was built to last. It's over 100 years old. Very historic. But what they're engaged in now, instead of training Franciscan friars, Job Corps is in training young people ages 16 to 24 for successful employment and careers. Now, for many, many years, it was inner city youth from New York City. And it's a secure campus because they're, you know, for them in an unknown land. But they really want to open it up more to the locals. It's still a secure campus for obvious reasons, but they want local youth ages 16 to 24 to be able to partake in the wonderful programs and services that they offer at Job Corps. So they're partnering with our Center for Workforce Development, which includes a youth component that we have, to open this up so that young people can get trained in, for example, we saw this very interesting demonstration of underground wire locator. I forget what the exact technical term is for it, but what they said is you can train for this in, I don't know, a few years and instantly be employable. You will instantly find employment. It will be a living wage with benefits. Companies are eager to hire because they need people to find underground cabling mm-hmm. with this special equipment. They can train you at Job Corps to do that, and you do not have to be from the inner city of New York City. You can be from Calicoon, from Woodburn, from Livingston Manor. You just have to be between ages 16 and 24.
We had spoken to the Delaware Valley Job Corps Center Director, Matthew Bliefernick, who was talking about how he's made this a point
yes.
to become more open to the community and to invite folks in to participate in these great programs that they have. For a while, it had been really like that, you know, that impenetrable stone building on the hill.
Yep.
But they're really trying to open up.
Yeah, and kudos to them. And I am so proud to say that the county is going to be partnering with them any way we can to the benefit of our local populace. Because, hey, we need folks who know vocational and technical skills here in Sullivan County as much as folks who will go to college.
Last week, we told folks about the Office of the Aging closing for a day because they had their RSVP
yes.
luncheon to prepare for. That was yesterday. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Wednesday. Yeah. What's today?
Today's Friday.
I spent all week thinking Tuesday was Thursday, so I'm not really sure. But on Wednesday, the RSVP luncheon, how did that go?
Yeah, we held it over at the Villa Roma and really just showed our appreciation to all our volunteers and the county officials who support them. There were well over 100, 150 people there from all corners of Sullivan County. We have a very robust retired senior volunteer program, RSVP, as most people know it. It's for folks 55 years and older to volunteer in their communities, and we have lots of opportunities. You are not stuck doing something you don't like or don't want to do or is too far away. We are extremely flexible with that. And so every year we want to honor them for the amazing amount of volunteerism that they do in the community, which we couldn't live without. I know I'm board president of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. We have a volunteer there from the RSVP program. She's great. And I got to sit with her and just tell her, I'm so thankful that you're with us. And she loves what she does, too.
And we have a couple of volunteers here that have come to us via RSVP, and they're great. We put out a monthly newsletter here at Radio Catskill called Soundings. We sent one out on September 19th, when was that? September 17th. And that was last week. Again, I don't know what day it is. But my point is, I heard from someone, Eva, who said, I don't know if this is the right place to email. She responded to the newsletter saying, I heard on the radio show about a food recycling program starting in Sullivan County. Who do I get? Who do I contact? So here's who you contact.
Yeah.
So again, people are interested in lots of different ways. Let's remind people again about this food scrap recycling pilot program and how you can get involved.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about this till people are tired of hearing me about it, but I think it's so cool that we're doing this. We have a food scrap recycling pilot program run through our recycling office by our recycling director, who is Cassie Thelman, who's a great person that but I hope everyone calls just to get to know. 807-0291 is where you can call her, and that's how you can sign up for this pilot program. You have to sign up for it right now because we have 400 starter kits that we're giving to people. We need to give them a little instruction and training on how to bring in their food scraps because we don't want like packaging or that kind of thing. We need just the scraps themselves, but we will take them off your hands for free. Ship them over to Ulster County where they will be turned into compost rather than sitting in a methane or sitting in a landfill creating methane.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Dan Hoost here every Friday giving us an update on Sullivan County government. We thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Have a great weekend. It's going to be a little wet, I think.
Yes.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, somebody you might know is going to be here.
Oh.
She's now the program coordinator at the Caregiver Resource Center. It's a partnership between CCE Sullivan and the Sullivan County Office of the Aging. Nancy McGraw.
I saw her at the RSVP luncheon. She was there. Yeah, we got caught up.
Nancy will be here next to tell us more about the Caregiver Resource Center and the programs that they offer. This is Radio Chatsko.
Support comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and restaurant on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, featuring local American fare, specialty cocktails, craft beers, and Sunday brunch. Menu and hours online at TavernOnMainNY.com.
And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Three generations of a black family, all looking for their own version of freedom, face homelessness, white violence, and mental illness in the new novel, The Unsettled. Best-selling author Ayanna Mathis asked the question, is it even possible to be black and free? She joins me, and we take your calls on what it means and what it takes to be liberated. Next time on Notes from America with Kai Wright.
Sunday evening at 6, live on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Research shows that participation in a support group can reduce caregiver stress and improve the quality of life for both the caregiver and the care receiver. Caregiving is stressful work that often causes people to go beyond their comfort zone. Family caregivers who are helping an elderly, sick, or disabled family member or friend can access various programs and services provided by the Caregiver Resource Center. It's a program partnership between CCE Sullivan and the Sullivan County Office of the Aging. And the center is hosting several upcoming programs. Joining us live in the studio now is Nancy McGraw, the new CRC program coordinator, to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to see you. Yeah,
you too. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's funny. I think that we talked so much over the last couple of years when you were the health department director about COVID. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall really sitting across from you in the studio.
We probably talked a lot on the phone.
We talked a lot on the phone.
Yes.
So it's good to see you. Thanks
you
for
too.
Being here.
And I love your new studio.
Thank you. What are some of the specific types of support that caregivers can get through the Caregiver Resource Center? That's that partnership from CCE Sullivan and the Office of the Aging that we mentioned.
You gave a really good introduction. You know, it's a partnership between the Office for the Aging and CCE and also the Alzheimer's Association. So there's a number of programs that we offer. We have weekly caregiver support groups that are open to everybody. Right now we're scheduling them virtually so they can be by phone or by Zoom. And we have a schedule out that's starting September 26th. From 4 to 5 p.m., and we do ask that people register. Now, it's interesting. People don't often self-identify as a caregiver, but, you know, they may be doing things like house cleaning or sorting medication, shopping, taking a loved one to the doctor's office, that sort of thing. And that's what a caregiver is. It can be a variety of different things, but a lot of people may not self-identify as a caregiver. So,
yeah, I mentioned in the introduction how caregiving is stressful, and I think many folks might identify a caregiver as something someone that's taking care of someone who's more incapacitated, perhaps, or more sick. But everyday things that you just mentioned are forms of caregiving. Can you talk about how that can impact someone's stress levels and how these programs can help?
Sure. It can at times be stressful for caregivers. And, you know, there's a lot of time and resources that go into helping a loved one or a family member, even a friend or a neighbor. And a lot of people may not think about it, but those hours add up.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a huge economic benefit to the community for all of the caregiving support and time that people provide to their family members and loved ones and friends. So the caregiver support groups really are there to, you know, some people may think, well, what do I need a support group for? I'm doing okay. Really, it's a way to connect with other people who are going through the same thing that you are, who may have suggestions on different things to try or different community resources to reach out to that may make the burden, I don't want to say burden, but the stresses of caregiving a little bit easier.
And you and people that you can talk to and identify with, and you may not see it initially as a stress or a burden, but then you can see how it does impact your life. And again, other people that are going through a similar situation to help get some of that support.
Right, right.
And as the new CRC coordinator, I think you started in just this summer, in July?
In July,
yeah. Mm-hmm. What are some of your goals and your vision for enhancing the support of resources for family caregivers?
So there's it's very interesting because there's a lot of training involved in these programs. And the Alzheimer's Association has a wonderful training program for a variety of different workshops and for caregiver support groups that they have volunteers go through. And so even though I work for the Caregiver Resource Center at Cornell Cooperative Extension, I'm also sort of a volunteer for the Alzheimer's Association. I had to go through all their trainings.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be scheduling very soon, and I'm working with local libraries and other locations, some workshops on dementia and Alzheimer's. And those, you know, those include the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's, understanding dementia and Alzheimer's, and a workshop called Healthy Living, Healthy Brain, and all about, you know, how to take care of yourself to be as healthy as you can, because dementia is a significant public health issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a significant issue for a lot of people who are concerned about their caregiving responsibilities. You know, and how do I manage when my spouse or my parent is suddenly more and more forgetful? Who do I reach out to? What can I do about this?
Do you find that caregiver support groups are underutilized?
They are. They're underutilized for a variety of reasons. It's very important that people understand that support groups are confidential. It's a way to share as little or as much as you would like to make friendships, really, with others who are going through something similar. I think there's a, especially with caregivers, there's a strong sense of independence. I can do this myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very helpful for people just to sit and listen to others who may have some helpful suggestions, to laugh, you know, to maybe just have coffee or talk about, you know, what the dog did today. So it's eases the stress of caregiving.
There's that emotional stress we're talking about,
yeah,
too, but there's also financial pressure.
Yes.
Navigating the health system. Are these some of the resources that the caregiver support group can also offer?
Absolutely. We connect people to community resources through the Office for the Aging, through healthcare providers. There is a care consultation service through the Alzheimer's Association that is completely free, and it's available 24/7. It's a helpline for caregivers of family members with struggling with dementia or Alzheimer's, and they can be reached at 800-272-3900. So, you know, we're sort of a central point of referral and information through the Caregiver Resource Center, and we can connect people to other services as well as support groups.
It's, I just want to go back to you for a minute. After leading the public health department in Sullivan County for so many years, working with the Rural Health Network, how is this for you, this transition, in terms of just you know, helping this community, which you've been so involved with?
It's wonderful. I really enjoy connecting with people in the community and other organizations, and it really allows me to do more hands-on support of the community, whereas before I was pretty much in an administrative role and, you know, a different sort of role, but I'm really enjoying this.
And are you seeing this community in a, you're saying that too, you're seeing it in a different light in terms of your responsibilities. Are you seeing it in a different way in terms of the population, the aging population? Are we seeing more of an aging population here?
Oh, definitely. You know, I recently last week went to a health symposium sponsored by the New York State Association of Rural Health. And they had one of the guest speakers was a director of the New York State Office for the Aging. So I think Greg Olson. And there is a New York State master plan on aging. Actually, the governor issued an executive order a while back. And because of the aging population, there's 16% of the New York State population is over 65 in New York. And by 2030, that's projected to be about over 5 million. Now, in Sullivan County, currently, we have a higher percentage of aging population over 65. We have 19.4% of Sullivan County residents are over the age of 65, and that's growing. So our aging population percentage is actually higher than the state rate.
And as the aging population grows, the caregiving population is going to grow.
Right.
And is growing.
And this is really designed to help people live in their home as long as possible, supported by their family members and friends, you know, to reduce caregiver stress and to really connect people to resources to allow them to avoid unnecessary hospitalizations or nursing home placement, which is very expensive.
Let's remind folks about the caregiver support group upcoming dates and times. I guess the next one's coming up on Tuesday.
Yes.
And then they happen every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday from September 26th through the almost the end of December, right before Christmas. And we also have a monthly caregiver support group specifically for individuals who have family members or other loved ones with dementia or Alzheimer's. And that's once a month on Wednesdays from 4 to 5. So you can find this on our website, Cornell Cooperative Extension, and also on our social media page.
Will these continue into the winter?
Yeah, this is just 3 months out. We'll be starting a new schedule in January.
All right. Nancy McGraw is the Sullivan CCE Caregiver Resource Center Program Coordinator. She's facilitating meetings and providing access to various educational resources for caregivers. There's more information about the caregiver support group at sullivancce.org or on their social media pages. Nancy, before we go, anything else you want to make sure listeners know?
No, I think that we'll be hearing more about resources, community resources for the aging population through the Caregiver Resource Center. There's a lot of resources. We're doing some planning for other programs, including in the future, Walk with Ease for people with arthritis and possibly Tai Chi.
Excellent. Nancy McGraw, thank you so much for being here. It's good to see you in
good
person.
Good to see you as well. Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a preview of the Woodstock Film Festival. This is Radio Chatskill.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom of almost 1,500 journalists. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency into the way those stories are told. I'm Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for a thoughtful and human look inside the most important stories of the day. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
Treatment takes time.
It also gives time back.
My addiction does not define who I am, just as my medication does not define my recovery.
All you have to do to change your life is change your mind.
It is up to you to figure out what is best for you.
Your goals.
Your life.
Your treatment plan.
Staying on medication for opioid use disorder is your path to recovery. Learn more at healtogetherstories.org.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop, some new music, and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from 52 and Vine, a wine and spirit shop in Jeffersonville featuring local, national, and eclectic vintners and distillers. 52andvine.com. From the Upper Delaware Welcome Center at the Narrowsburg Union, featuring information about regional attractions and activities, along with products by the region's artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen at Catskills Curated. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It seems that the director of the Woodstock Film Festival, Myra Blaustein, is feeling a little under the weather this morning, so we're going to reschedule that interview. In the meantime, spotted lanternflies are still an issue in the area. They are a threat to crops and trees, and yes, you should still try to kill them. We have an interview that we did a little earlier this month, last month actually, with the folks at the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Invertebrate Zoology, Jessica Ware. She's the associate curator. I spoke with her about how they got here and how to get rid of them.
Ah, good question. So a spotted lanternfly is a kind of bug. So some insects are not bugs. Bugs are actually a kind of an insect called a hemiptera. They have sucking mouth parts and they like to drink the sap of plants. So a spotted lanternfly is a kind of bug. Their closest relatives are things like cicadas, stink bugs, things like that. And the reason why they're harmful to plants is really not in their drinking, but spotted lanternflies can be harmful because they're drinking a sugary tree sap solution, and so their poop is basically what we call honeydew, or it's a sugary, watery poop, and that can lead to kind of fungus and mold growing on the plants where they poop, where they're pooping. So for crops that we're interested in, using for economic purposes, apples and grapes and things like that, there's a risk that the spotted lanternfly, if they're feeding on them and pooping on them, that this kind of black kind of mold and sooty fungus can grow on them.
We've heard that you should be mindful of the spotted lanternfly and that they're invasive. How big of a threat are they?
They're a fairly big threat in that spotted lanternflies, since they've arrived in the United States in around 2014 in Pennsylvania, they have been steadily establishing and kind of moving westward. They now are in all across New Jersey. They're in New York. They're in Massachusetts. They're in Pennsylvania. They're in Ohio. They're in Indiana. They're in Michigan. They're in Iowa. So they're starting to infest further and further west. What we're concerned about is that we don't want them to become an established pest, and we don't want them to threaten some of our large crops in California, you know, like grapes and apples and things like that.
How did they get here?
It's always hard to know, to pinpoint exactly when a pest arrives, because we are, prone to transoceanic commerce, and being in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, we have a lot of stuff coming in and out of our ports. But we think that they arrived perhaps with shipping of some goods, perhaps for landscaping, perhaps for we don't always know if there was one or multiple introductions of a new pest, but that is the main way that they come here is on transoceanic commerce.
And you mentioned that they're attracted to plants and to trees. Are there specific plants and trees that they're attracted to?
Well, they really are. The reason why we feel panicked a little bit about the potential of them being coming well established is that they can feed on a lot of different types of trees. So they have a really wide range of host plants is what we call them. They love Tree of Heaven, Ailanthus, which in itself is an invasive plant. It's not native to North America, but they also can feed on black walnut and maples, especially red maple, silver maple. They can feed on willow, river birch, black cherry, you know, poplar. So they also can feed on grapes and peaches and hops. And so there's quite a few things that they can feed on.
How can they be controlled?
Well, one thing that people can do is they can report infestations of spotted lanternfly when they see them, and that can help the agricultural entomologists in the area where you're residing really best kind of manage the movement and spread of this pest. So that would be step one, would be make sure that when you're seeing them that you're kind of reporting them. And most of the kind of folks who are working on spotted lanternfly, they have websites and things where you can enter on forms where you've seen them, take photos on iNaturalist and things like that, and with an app on your phone. If you do find that they're around the trees in your yard, for example, you can put up kind of sticky tape around the bark of your tree, and you want to cover it with a mesh, so that way the spotted lanternflies, if their nymphs are walking up the tree, which is a natural behavior for them, they'll walk up the bark of the tree, they actually can get stuck on this sticky tape, but it's not going to also stick birds and other things that might accidentally get stuck. That's what you don't want, is to catch other things. You kind of want to harness, you know, the natural behavior of spotted lanternflies, which is to walk up the tree trunk and kind of just catch them on this kind of sticky tape. So you want to kind of sometimes cover it with a bit of mesh. That can be a very effective way to kind of stop some of the nymphs. The adults can be tricky to catch. They are very good tree. They hop and kind of glide a little bit forward, so they can be rather tricky to stomp on. Some people suggested, you know, stomping on them if you see them. That can be a fun thing to try and chase them, I suppose. I've seen kids doing it, but they're actually pretty hard to catch. So some have recommended that getting rid of the egg stage might be a really good strategy. The eggs look kind of like, you know, a dried up piece of grayish kind of colored chewing gum that sticks to the barks of trees and sometimes houses and even cars. And so scraping off those eggs and putting them in a sealed, you know, plastic bag and disposing of them can be a good strategy to kind of prevent the next generation from becoming a problem next summer.
Are they harmful to humans or dangerous to pets?
They're not harmful to humans. They're not dangerous to pets. We don't know of a lot of things that like to eat them. In fact, spotted lanternflies have kind of a classic warning coloration. They're kind of red and black. They're black and it's actually gorgeous. They're black with white polka dots in the very early instar stages of the nymphs. Then they become red with black polka dots, gorgeous also. And then the adults have part of their wings are kind of a bright red color, and part of their wings are kind of a black and white and pink and gray check, you know, polka dotted color. When we see warning coloration, usually that tells predators that they might be distasteful. And researchers have found, indeed, they are rather distasteful. So very few things like to eat them. But as far as we know, there's nothing harmful to any pets or to humans, but they probably don't taste very good.
Yeah, the picture is, they're pretty, but don't be fooled by their beauty. They're dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the thing with insects is that they've been around a lot longer than us. And this, you know, this lowly spotted lanternfly is just living its life, right? It feeds on plant sap. There's plant sap. It drinks it. It poops. It's just kind of going about its regular day-to-day. The problem is that it's not native to here, so it can affect the ecosystem because every species in a community are kind of, they're all interacting together. And its poop, if it falls on things that are economically important to humans, that can be problematic. They can be a nuisance because there's so many of them, and sometimes humans find them to be unsettling. But when you think about all of those negatives, you know, they're, it's not that it's out to get us, you know, it's just kind of living its regular life. It's just feeding and pooping and going about its day to day. It just happens to be that it's not really, invasive species can be a cause of insect decline. You know, we don't want to outcompete native taxa, and we don't, as humans, want economic damage to our crops.
And what is the life cycle of the spotted lanternfly?
So it's in a group of insects that have what's called incomplete metamorphosis. So people are probably familiar with butterflies. They go from an egg to a caterpillar to a cocoon, and then an adult butterfly that looks very different from the juvenile. Spotted lanternflies are not like that. They're part of a group of insects where the juveniles, kind of the babies, look a little bit like the adults. They just keep getting larger and larger as they molt to adulthood. So the life cycle is that it goes from an egg to what we call nymphs or juveniles, and they molt a few times to larger and larger sizes until eventually they're in the adult stage. So the juvenile, the baby spotted lanternflies, have very small wing nubs. You know, their wings aren't very long, and they get longer and longer with each successive instar until the adult stage where they have fully formed wings.
They're back for another summer. How long will they be here, and then when will they come back around?
We'll be here all summer, and right now this is a time when they're kind of feeding and finding a mate and then laying eggs. So we expect the eggs usually to hatch in May and June, and then they start, eating and growing through May, June, July. And then July to September is when they're just kind of starting to become adults. And then we would expect to see, adults mating kind of near the end of the summer and then start laying their eggs in September, October, November, and then those eggs over winter. So it's really a good time, like right around Halloween-y time, a little bit before Halloween, to go out and look for eggs and kind of start scraping them off and disposing of them to prevent next summer from being a bad spotted lanternfly year.
We've been speaking to Jessica Ware, Associate Curator in the American Museum of Natural History Museum's Division of Invertebrate Zoology about the threat of spotted lanternflies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There's more information about invasive species at dec.ny.gov. In Pennsylvania, that's at agriculture.pa.gov. And more information about the American Museum of Natural History at amnh.org. Before we go, we've got a couple of special guests in the studio, Patricio Rubio and Jason Dole. Hello.
Hello.
There's more news coming up later tonight on the local edition. Patricio, what do you have going on?
Tonight, it's Friday, so we talked to Chris Rowley from the Shawangunk Journal. He's going to let us know what's happening in Ellenville. And we talk about the Plan for Progress's report recently on housing. And the limitations it has and what's coming up. Also, I had to have a nice conversation with a board member from the Liberty Museum about the upcoming poetry festival that's starting actually today and is going through the week and almost next weekend, and talk about the programming and the significance of having poets and poet events in Liberty.
That's tonight on the local edition at 6. And Jason, we have a big Radio Catskill event coming up on Thursday, our community awards.
Boy, do we ever. We got our annual community awards where we recognize amazing things in the community, and we're celebrating arts and culture this year, and we would love to have you there to help us out. First off, we're giving awards to some of our absolute favorite acronyms doing so much in the community. CAS, the Catskill Art Space, DVAA, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, NACL, North American Cultural Laboratory, also the Wayne County Arts Alliance. We're giving awards to two great musical institutions that bring music to the mountains with Chandelier Music Festival, Weekend of Chamber Music, both of which are celebrating big anniversaries this year. They're 30th anniversaries, yeah. Right?
Yep, 30th anniversaries for both of those, and so many great arts organizations in our area, and we're so pleased to be able to honor a few of them. There's more information, ticket information at wjffradio.org. Please join us at the event on Thursday at Seminary Hill Orchard and Cidery in Calicoon. And I will admit to both of you that I brought you in under the pretense of promoting your show and the community awards, but really I just wanted to say thank you again publicly and recognize you publicly for the 5 New York State Broadcasters Association awards that you received yesterday in Binghamton. Congratulations again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Our mission here is to serve our community with meaningful local news and information. You guys do that every day. And you do it selflessly. And again, want to point out that the guys here brought in awards in best coverage of spot news, best feature story, best interview, best election coverage, and a Serving New York Award, which recognized the extraordinary efforts of New York State broadcasters in serving the public interests every day. These are statewide awards. And congratulations. How was Binghamton?
Oh, it was great. I always love going to Binghamton, and it's great to see other people in this industry and see. Well, good thing this year they had played clips of all the award winners. So we were able to see other stations and what they're doing.
And hear what they're doing. Yeah. And award. And it was amazing to have this room of all these broadcasters gathered. Then you're hearing like a clip of our coverage of the local reaction to the Roe versus Wade decision or our coverage of local election. And I just want to say thank you to all of our partners, in other media outlets that help us do what we do, like that election coverage where we had correspondents from other publications everywhere. It's good stuff. So thanks.
And thank you for all you guys do. Again, we appreciate it, and we could hear more of it tonight on the local edition at 6. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from
Jeffersonville Bake Shop, offering breakfast and lunch to go or to stay, and coffee, Wi-Fi, and space for getting work done remotely. JeffersonvilleBakeShop.com. From the Schwangunk Journal, serving the towns of Warwissing, Crawford, Mamikating, Rochester, Schwangunk, and everything in between. SchwangunkJournal.com. And from listeners like you.
Radio makes you listen, but it also makes you dream and feel and think. Tune in to All Things Considered for the inspiration you need to end your day.
Weekdays at 4. WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Broadcasting from our studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Listen local.